Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Etan Thomas. He's something of a renaissance man in the world of sports. After playing basketball for 4 years at Syracuse University and an 11-year career in the NBA, he has published poetry, written a memoir about fatherhood, and is an active commentator and contributor to a variety of national media outlets, particularly on issues of sports and politics, and most recently on sports, social activism, and race. Which brings us to his new book, titled We Matter, Athletes and Activism. It's based on interviews with prominent athletes and others involved in the media and sports. Etan, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, let me just start with a really basic question. I mean, tell me about the decision to write this book. How'd you decide to write it?
Well, there's a lot going on in society, and a lot of athletes were using their positions as platforms kind of in an unprecedented way. Of course, we saw this a lot in the 60s. Of the time of Bill Russell and Kareem Muhammad Ali. But then you saw athletes, you know, who might have not really spoken out quite often start to speak out. And I just wanted to capture it. You know, there was a lot of going on with police brutality. I think that was really one of the things, the catalyst that really pushed a lot of athletes to really be able to use their platforms. And I wanted to just capture it all in the book.
So tell me how you went about writing it. It was based on interviews, but how did you approach it? How did you set it up?
Well, it affected me personally a lot as well, you know, seeing what happened. I think Trayvon Martin was really like a major thing that really, you know, kind of gripped everybody. And, you know, it gripped me as well. You know, my son, Malcolm, he's 12 years old now, but he was, that was a few years ago. And, you know, if I always say it that, you know, if I put a hoodie on Malcolm, you know, he looked just like Trayvon Martin. And so you had
I remember
a lot of,
the president said that.
The president
too,
said that. Dwayne Wade said it when I interviewed him in the book. You know, LeBron James talked about that a lot, you know, as far as his reasons why the entire Miami Heat really took that stance and supported Trayvon Martin. So that's kind of what I saw as kind of the catalyst to really start this path of a new resurgence of athletes and activism and athletes using their platform and speaking out. And it just kind of went on from there. I mean, you had different things happen and more athletes using their platforms. And, you know, you have Kaepernick and you have LeBron and you have, you know, Russell Westbrook and Carmelo and all these different things going on. And there's just been this wave of new activism. And I, you know, I just wanted to touch on it all in the book.
So what do you hope the book helps to do? Do you have specific goals for it?
Definitely. You know, for one, I wanted to really encourage the future athletes to really be able to be inspired and hear the stories of athletes from yesteryear and current athletes of how they're using their positions and their platforms. Because that's the way I was inspired when I was younger. Reading about athletes like Muhammad Ali and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you know, I'm like in middle school. My mother's giving me different books and things of that nature, reading about what Bill Russell did, what Muhammad Ali did, what John Carlos did. And I want the same next generation to be influenced the same way by the current athletes.
Is that where your own commitment to social activism comes from? Is it back there in your childhood and that experience of reading those accounts?
Definitely, because I was reading about them and I was just amazed at the amount of courage that it must have taken for them to take those stances. I mean, we got to go back. This is back in the 60s, you know, when, you know, John Carlos on the biggest stage, you know, in the 1968 Olympics, and he makes this statement, and it's like the entire world comes down on him, and he still stands strong. I mean, I just thought that was amazing.
And you're referring to that iconic image of Tommy Smith, I think it was, and Carlos on the podium there with their fist raised in the air wearing black gloves.
Right. And with Peter Norman, who all stood with them in solidarity.
Right.
And, you know, then you had Muhammad Ali, who was on the biggest stage. He just won the heavyweight championship of the world. I mean, he's, you know, he's king of the world. And, you know, he's using his position. He says, no, he's not going to enter himself into the draft. He's going to stand on his principles, all of his things that he stood up for, and how the entire country turned on him, but he still stood strong in what he believed in. I remember just being, you know, in middle school reading about that and learning about it. And I was just, you know, just amazed, like, wow, that must have taken so much courage to be able to stand up and everybody is against you. So that kind of, you know, started the path of me reading about more and more athletes that use their positions and their platforms.
Was your mother a social activist of a kind? I mean, did she do things outside and engage in political participation?
She definitely did. Yeah. You know, my mother was a teacher. So from that standpoint, you know, she liked to have me reading about anything. But she really wanted to educate me, you know, in addition to the education that I was getting in school. So I was learning about my history, learning about my culture, learning about these athletes and this aspect of these athletes. You know what I mean? She didn't just want me to, you know, back in that time, everybody was kind of just looking at the videos, come fly with me, or something like that, but you're not really looking in depth in the athlete. Do you know what I mean? So that's what she really always wanted to stress, the importance of who the athlete was as a person, not just what they could do on the football field or the basketball court or in their particular arena.
So who were your own role models as a player and now as a former athlete? Mm-hmm. Who do you regard as your role models?
Well, those are the athletes that I really looked up to. Okay. The Muhammad Ali's, the John Carlos, the Bill Russell, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And that's why it was such a tremendous honor to be able to interview them for the book. I mean, I'm talking to, Layla Ali, who was Muhammad Ali's daughter. And, I'm interviewing Bill Russell, interviewing Kareem. And it was just amazing in the amount of depth they took for the interview. And, they really wanted to touch on different topics and talk about pull back the layers of what it means to be an activist, the criticism that comes with it, how much they think that everybody, not just athletes, this is one of Kareem's biggest points, to use their voices in whatever particular arena that they are, not to just put it all on athletes. I mean, it was really a great experience to have, to be able to sit down with them.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Atan Thomas, former NBA player and the author of We Matter, Athletes and Activism. I wanted to get your take. I'm curious about this, is whether you think the possibilities and the challenges for athlete activism are different for women athletes, and in particular African-American women athletes.
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, it was an honor to be able to interview Swin Cash and Tamika Catchings in particular, talking about the level of activism of what they were able to be a part of. Now, what they were able to be a part of was something that was really, I haven't seen anything like that, where the WNBA, and I was referring to about after Philando Castile and Alton Sterling's murders, like within a matter of 24 hours, they were like back-to-back police, shootings. And it kind of took everybody by storm, like, oh, my gosh, like this, you're reading about one, and then the next day you're reading about the next one. And as an entire league, as the WNBA, as an entire league, they got together and they said, listen, we have to do something. So first they wore T-shirts that said Black Lives Matter. And, then they had a media blackout that said, okay, after every game, what they're going to do is only talk about this topic. And that, they might briefly say something about the game, but after that, the only questions that they will answer were questions about social justice, police brutality, reform, what needs to happen, things of that nature. And they did it as an entire league. Mm. I mean, that was just amazing to me. At first they did it and they were threatened to have fines and things of that nature. Then it's like they all banded together and did it all the way, as a complete league, every single team. And I was just asking him about that. Like, what did it mean for you to be able to do that, as a league, as for younger women who are watching you? I have two daughters. They're watching them, and they're inspired by seeing the way they stood up for their, things of that nature. And it was just, like I said, it's just a great project to really be able to just really cover this topic of athletes and activism from every angle.
And how does this, both the responsibility for social activism and also the risks involved in doing it, how do you think that plays out for athletes at the college level and even maybe at the high school level? Mm-hmm. Because we were talking a little bit about this off microphone, but, there are pressures that athletes at that level are under that might be different from a professional athlete.
Definitely. And I think one of the things that you're seeing right now, especially after the thing with Kaepernick as far as taking the knee, and you're seeing these high school athletes across the country who are taking a knee, but then expressing their reasons of why they're taking a knee, and not just high school athletes. You're looking at, high school students. I mean, what the students are doing right now in Florida, after that horrendous school shooting, and they're having their voices be heard. Mm-hmm. So they're not even, saying that they're young, they're high school students, who's going to listen to them? They're banding together and they're doing things where people are forced to listen to them. And that's the beauty of activism. And that's really what Kareem's point always is he doesn't want it to just be on the athletes. He wants everybody to use their positions and their platforms. And that's why what we're seeing, especially with young people all across the country right now, it's really beautiful to see them using their voices the way that they are.
You mentioned the Colin Kaepernick example, and that actually ties with something else I wanted to ask you about in this vein of how it plays out for different folks that have different roles in athletics. And this one is about coaches and management. It seems like that's an important piece of the puzzle, too. And with the case of the football players, it kind of went from the players to the management. And I wanted to get your reflections on how that plays out in your view and the importance of that.
Well, there's a great importance of, you know, coaches and managements to be able to use their voice as well. I interviewed Kenny Smith from TNT, and that was a big part of what he discussed. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to interview different people in management to specifically get their opinion, their take on athlete activism. So, I went to Adam Silver, who's, of course, the commissioner of the NBA, and I went to Mark Cuban, who is the CEO of the Dallas Mavericks, Ted Leonsis, who is the CEO of the Washington Wizards, and Steve Kerr. You know, he's a coach of the Golden State Warriors. So I wanted to talk to them about how they handle activism and what they feel about it. And, you know, they all pretty much gave me the same type of response, that they have a respect for athlete activism, and they understand the history of it and the place for it and the importance of it. And it's something that they have respect for. And it was really great to be able to hear that, because I wanted them to be able to express, because the thing about it is, a lot of times you'll hear that that you'll be hurting your chances, or you'll be, kind of making it hard for yourself if you step out and say something, or somebody, you're going to be punished in some way. And that's why I was so proud to see that Syracuse University actually issued the statement that no high school students who are, you know, going to protest about gun reform will not be held against you. You know, I wanted to, out then, and in the book, I wanted to get Adam Silver, commissioner of the NBA, to say the same thing. I wanted to get Mark Cuban to say the same thing, and Ted Leonsis, and they all said it before I even asked them. Mm. Like, no, we would never punish anybody because of they speaking out on something, even if they speak out on something that you disagree with, because that's usually the key part.
Right.
Anybody could appreciate if somebody speaks out with something that they agree with. It's when they say something that you don't agree with.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Atan Thomas, an 11-year veteran of the NBA. He's a media commentator and contributor, and the author of the new book, We Matter, Athletes and Activism. I wanted to get your thoughts about President Trump getting involved in this national conversation about activism and athletes, and he's done it in a pretty direct and oftentimes fairly unvarnished way.
That's one way to put it.
You can put it another way. Go ahead. But what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I think it was interesting. And one of the things that I wanted to do with the book was to get it back to the reason why athletes were actually protesting, why they were taking a knee. You know what I mean? Why LeBron James and, you know, Carmelo Anthony and all these different athletes were out protesting and using their voices. And it wasn't about the flag. It wasn't about the military. Kaepernick pretty much listed the reasons of why he was taking a knee. He said he was protesting political corruption, which he didn't like the way that the entire, political landscape was forming. He thought that we deserved more options and things of that nature. He talked about systemic racism. He talked about police brutality. And then somehow it got transferred to being about the military and about the country. And that's really what Donald Trump really did. And what I really wanted to do with this book is really take it back to what it was originally about, with those topics that Kaepernick pretty much laid out. Like I said, it was a lot about police brutality. And, you know, Eric Reed, who was the other of Kaepernick's teammates that was kneeling with him the entire time, talked about that a lot in the book, about how it really hurt them seeing all of the different unarmed black males and females who were being killed by the police, and then nothing happening. You know what I mean? The police getting either not indicted or, you know, not guilty charged. And he was like, wait, something has to happen. This can't just keep happening over and over again. And I interviewed Torrey Smith, who was also, he was a teammate of Kaepernick's at the time, but now he just won the Super Bowl with the Eagles. And he was talking about the same thing, about as far as the transfer of what the original meaning was supposed to be about, and how that was kind of meticulously done. Because, you know, when you heard people talk about the taking a knee, they never talked about the issues that Kaepernick brought up. You know what I mean? It was always about the military and the flag. And he was like, and even though he said this is not in any kind of disrespect of the military or the flag, you know, it's just kind of that's where. And I saw, you know, Donald Trump pretty much had a big hand in that as well.
Now, the book relies a lot on interviews, and you've been talking about them, and you conducted these interviews with, again, prominent athletes, relatives of some of the victims.
Right.
And then others involved in media or sports. I wanted to know, what was the hardest interview
for you to do? By far, it was the relatives of the victims mm-hmm. of police brutality. I mean, I interviewed Trayvon Martin's brother, mm-hmm. and, you know, I almost had to pause it for a minute because to kind of, you know, gather myself when he told me that, you know, if it weren't for athletes, he doesn't know if anybody would know his brother's name. And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, well, you know, when this first happened, my family was trying to get one of the news stations down in Florida to cover it, and none of them wanted to cover it. They said, well, this isn't really a story. A young black man being killed, this is not a story that happens all the time. And I was like, wow. You know, and he said, yeah, when LeBron and D. Wade and everybody, and they started, the entire Miami Heat team brought attention to it, then everybody kind of started paying attention. You know, and you know, Tiffany Crutcher, who was Terrence Crutcher's sister, talked about when she saw Russell Westbrook on TV talking about how unfair it was and how unjust it was that her brother was killed in the manner that he was killed by the police, that, you know, when he was just pulled over on the side of the road and he didn't do anything wrong. But seeing Russell Westbrook say that, you know, what it meant to them, you know, and I interviewed Eliza Castile, who said the same thing about the WNBA player. So those were the hardest interviews for me to really do, because I'm looking at them and I'm seeing the pain in their face and I'm seeing the torment and everything like that. And I was just, you know, trying to keep my composure and do the interview. And they were so thankful that I wanted to interview them. And I was just like, wow, the whole interaction with all of the victims, that was tough.
Which of the interviews that you did surprised you the most? It just gave you something you completely weren't expecting to hear?
Well, Chris Hayes' interview from MSNBC, he was so excited to talk about this topic. And he said, because he doesn't really get to talk about this as much. It's just always, you know, now everything is Trump, Trump, Trump. Right. That's all he's talking about every time. So he was talking about the differences of fandom and then looking at you as a human being and respecting your opinion, even if you don't agree with it. And he was really interested in that dynamic. You know, he's like, because you have fans that love you, that wear your jersey and stuff like that. But then you say something that they don't agree with. And it's like, now that fandom just kind of vanishes, and then they don't like you anymore, and they take your jersey down and take your, you know. And it was a real interesting dynamic that he was really, you know, intrigued by. And I just didn't think he would be that intrigued by it, but he was really intrigued by it.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Atan Thomas, NBA veteran and author of We Matter, Athletes and Activism. Reading in your book, the conversations that you've had with your son appear mm-hmm. frequently in
yes.
the book, your renditions of those. What was the hardest thing in all of this for you to explain to him? Because you have a lot of accounts where you're explaining things to your son
right.
as he's growing up.
Well, just that things aren't fair sometimes, you know? I mean, that's just the way that there's no other way that I could say it. Things just aren't fair. You know, he's reading about different cases, and he's seeing, you know, like, for instance, we're talking about Sandra Bland. And he was like, wait, so what did she do wrong?
Mm.
And it was like, well, you know, in their eyes, that she was talking back and she wasn't, you know, following the instructions. He's like, yeah, but she didn't do anything wrong, like a threat or anything. I'm like, yeah, that's true. But you can't do that. You know, and he, you know, you'll see different situations where you'll see on TV, other people will do things that you can't get away with, that I can't get away with. And that's just the way it is. You know, it's a tough pill to really swallow, especially for a 12-year-old, you know what I mean, who is, you know, wants to look at the world in kind of Disney-colored glasses, that everything is just fair and everything is equal and everybody's treated equally and everything. I was like, no, Tamir Rice was 12 years old. You know, he had a toy gun that he was playing with in a park. And, you know, you saw how the police reacted to him. I was like, we just have to know that there's certain things that we just can't do. It's not fair, but we can't do. And, you know, and he's looking at the different cases, like right now, like I said, the mass shooter in Florida,
mm-hmm.
you know, he just slaughtered 17 people and they took him alive. I was like, that the rules are different sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's just tough. It's just a tough pill to swallow.
Also in your book, your fellow Syracuse Orange basketball player. You weren't teammates, but mm-hmm. you share that connection, Carmelo Anthony.
Yes.
He told you about a dialogue that he had put together in Los Angeles, I think mm-hmm. it was, with the players, police, public officials, and youth for a discussion. And it sounded in the book like it was a pretty powerful experience.
No, definitely. And I've put together different things of that nature in with police, because you don't want to develop a situation where they're thinking that all police are one way. And you don't want the police to look at you and thinking that all young black males are one way. So you try to bridge the gap a little bit. And we've had situations and things of that nature where we're having a policeman come and talk to young people and they're bouncing questions off of them. I've done a couple of things like that. And Carmelo was referring to one that he did as well in L.A. before they went over to the Olympics. And, he said, of course, it had its moments of intensity, like you would imagine it would. And, as long as you have policemen that are open and honest, and there's going to be a lot of tension, but they can't get offended as soon as they hear the attention, because they have to understand the gravity of the situation and the gravity of the topic. But, I was really, proud of Carmelo for, the amount of risks he takes as far as his activism, because a lot of these things could go either way. A lot of these things could be interpreted either way. I mean, like right after Freddie Gray was killed in Baltimore, he went down to Baltimore and marched with the people in Baltimore. Now,
that's his hometown.
That's his hometown. Yeah, right. Yeah. And of course, him marching there means something. Mm-hmm. Him standing with the people and saying, OK, I'm here in supportive of you. Yes. OK. And now we have to be able to, it just takes so much courage for him to do. And it's not something that he has to do, but it's something that is very meaningful for him to do. That's why it's a great honor for me to have him in this book.
This is a kind of a sharper edged version of this question. But in your discussion of how this worked with the things that you've put on, and you were describing the one that Carmelo Anthony put on, I feel like I have to ask it. Is this problem, though, something that we can talk our way out of? I mean, if we talk long enough, we're going to solve this.
Well, it's not just talk. There's a lot of different variables of it. Talking is one thing, because mm-hmm. number one, I can say the police have to be able to look at young black males who they're in contact with as humans, not as targets. Do you know what I mean? So they don't see, there used to be a thing of community policing, and I'm a big proponent of community policing, where the policemen actually live in the community, they're part of the community, and then they have an invested interest in what happens in the community. That's what happened when I was younger. I mean, I knew some of the policemen. I had mm-hmm. interactions with them. They went to my church. Their sons went to my school. And you know what I mean? We saw them. Hey, officer, Blaze, how you doing? We knew who they were. And that's a big difference. But sometimes, they're only from the policeman's standpoint. They're looking at, whatever they've gone through, because you have to look at their standpoint as well. And they see a young black male, they immediately see a target. Mm. And the problem is the young black male that they're seeing as targets are getting younger and younger and younger. And it's a scary thought as a father, of a young black male who is tall for his age, So there's certain levels of the talk that we have to have with our children from a younger age that is something new for mainstream America to really wrap their minds around, because it's not something that they have to necessarily worry about, because it's not the same situation. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
What I like that Tori Smith was talking about as far as what they do with their police engagement is try to improve, and Anquan Boldin as well, the football player as well. They're trying to change laws, change
yeah.
different rules, change things where, there's a different due process going on when something happens. And, it's each police department. It's kind of ran differently. It's mm-hmm. not like just one federal way and all of them are ran the same way. So each one is kind of ran differently. So what Tori Smith was talking about, what they did, especially after Kaepernick, and this is like a tangible, sometimes people talk about what are tangible solutions that have happened after Kaepernick has made a stance. It's like, well, the 49ers, every time they played an away game, they went to different police departments and had these different forums, and they talked about different things of ways to improve relationships between the police and the community, and different things that the policemen could change as far as the format and the rules and regulations of how they would police. I thought that was great. I was like, why don't more people know that this happened? You know what I mean? Why people don't know that y'all are doing this? And he was like, well, that I don't know, but this is what we did after this. So There are different ways, but you just got to, there's something that it can be frustrating, but you can't give up.
Right. We just got about a minute and a half left, but there's a change of topic here, but I wanted to ask you this question. Most of the media attention lately on athletes and activism is focused on the kinds of issues that we've been talking about, racial issues, and more specifically than that, the behavior and decisions of people in the criminal justice system. But for you and some others, the activism goes well beyond that. And I wanted to bring up something from your career. You spoke out against the war in Iraq back in 2003, for example, and paid some price for that. Only about a minute left, but could you talk a little bit about that decision and that experience for you?
Well, that was one where, you know, the invasion of Iraq happened, and I'm looking at all the facts and looking at all the details, and I'm just like, wait a minute, this doesn't add up. What does this have to do? What does A have to do with B? You know, and I was like, well, I don't really agree with this. And it was a situation where I was I do a lot of poetry and spoken word, and then, you know, I started doing a lot of performances around D.C. So, well, there was this big rally that I was in. And I didn't know how big it was, but it was huge. So it went viral before viral was a thing, because there wasn't like social media or anything like that. And, you know, there were strong reactions from both ways. You know, some people that really agreed with it and pat me on the shoulder, said, this is great that you did it. Other people who were very upset that I said what I said. I mean, now looking back, everybody would say, well, Iraq wasn't a good idea. But back then, it was really only like, you know, a few people like Michael Moore, the Dixie Chicks, a few more people that were really saying anything. And so it was a risk. It was definitely a risk. But it was one where, you know, the management with the Washington Wizards were supportive of me. And they you know, that was my experiences. And that's why I want to talk about that in the book, that my experience wasn't necessarily that you need to just shut up and dribble, or like Laura Ingraham said, or anything like that. But, you know, with management that have, you know, even if they don't agree with your actual position, they still respect you for taking that position, but you have to be able to, of course, articulate it and being able to, you know, not do anything that's detrimental to the program or anything like that, and defend yourself against naysayers and criticizers, because that's what's definitely going to happen.
That was Etan Thomas, and again, his new book is titled We Matter, Athletes and Activism. Etan, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.